This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
A lone, shadowy man stands at the road, surveying the dark exterior of a modest cabin. Dim lights flicker through the parlor window. Shadows of inhabitants, heads bowed, decorate the interior wall, frozen in form, but for the subtle waves imposed by the candle creating them. The man stiffens as a sudden wind hits the back of his neck. When it ceases, the surrounding forest falls silent and heavy once more. As if that is the cue, he gives a grunt and begins his amble up the front path to the door. The door creaks open before he can raise his hand to knock. A young boy stands on the threshold, eyes downcast. Not out of shyness, the man knows this, but out of fear, precaution, superstition. A murmured command from somewhere within the house is followed by the boy pulling the door open and stepping aside. Without a word, the man steps into the warm, dim, heavy, silent glow. The air is thick with aromatic florals and herbs, and a familiar something else underneath. Death smells like nothing else, and is a hard scent to cover. No one stands to greet, to welcome the newcomer. They've been expecting, though not thrilled, for his arrival. All persons in the room remain focused on the corpse lying on the table at the far end. The man shuffles past the mourners. As he passes, only one risks the direct glare. It's not that the man doesn't care about this. He just can't let it bother him in this moment. There's a job to be done, and he alone can do it. He approaches the corpse's side. The previous silent ambiance becomes a sudden, stark hush. A pin could drop, and people would startle. The man looks down upon the deceased's face as he reaches with both hands for the bread and cup of ale set upon their chest. Holding them above the body, he closes his eyes and begins. I pledge my soul for your sins. I ask that God Almighty remove them from you and place them upon me. By this bread and by this drink, I consume your burden. What was yours to carry is now mine to carry. If I lie, may God strike me dead. For thy peace, I pawn my soul. Amen. And with that, he sets about eating the loaf, drinking the ale, consuming the sin of the departed that both items had soaked up, taking them into himself, and thus allowing the person's spirit a clean slate and untroubled passage into heaven. Sin-eating is a very old practice hailing from Britain, primarily Wales, though not entirely. It was thought if a person were unable to confess their sins prior to death, their soul may be endangered and unable to enter heaven, may become stuck, may become restless. There were a few reasons why confession, absolution, and last rites were not always accessible, including affordability with the lower classes and even scarcity of clergy in certain areas in the face of a sudden death. Out of desperation and necessity to do right by their dead, people found their solution, much to their obligated acceptance for the act, The sin eater was traditionally a social outcast of some sort, someone who might be considered expendable to begin with, beggars and the poor, mentally disabled and otherwise undesirable. Though in modern times we may look back upon what they did as a form of selfless heroism, the role of sin eater was unenviable and highly stigmatized. Performing the work that they did made them more of a social pariah than before. It was thought to be bad luck to stare a sin eater in the eyes. It was suspected that they grew more evil the longer they performed the act and the more sins they took upon themselves. The role often paid very little, came with automatic isolation. Sin eaters often pushed to live on the outskirts of town. They were heavily ostracized by the same community who needed the very services that made their reputation so bad. Following their visits, they were handed a meager sixpence and ushered out the door, sometimes shooed away with words or rocks. But sin eating continued against church doctrine and with the community's growing disapproval as the tolerated necessity that it was. Now, not all sin eaters were created alike. Some did perform their services completely by choice, such as a man named Richard Munslow, who lived in Rattling Hope, Shrewsbury, in the UK. Richard was a wealthy farmer. He was well-liked in his community, and he became their sin eater, understanding the great need and the heartbreak of sudden loss, having lost four of his own children quickly and at very young ages. About a century following his death, the locals of the area put their money together to restore his memorial stone at his gravesite in gratitude and remembrance of the sacrifice he made and to honor his chosen trade. Not many other sin eaters were honored or remembered so. As a matter of fact, we will forever be in the dark as to their names, how many there were, all of the families they helped, where they are buried. It's just not something folks were proud of or wanted acknowledged. That being the case, Richard Munslow really stands out. It is said he was the last known sin eater. It is said the wider spread of the practice basically fizzled out in the 19th century, and Richard had simply resurrected it, officially bringing it to a close in 1906, the year of his death. It's also been said the practice was not one to really make its mark in the New World, or if it did, it certainly didn't last long. But that math ain't mathin'. Logic and a little bit of digging tells us otherwise. Like I mentioned, sin eating was a practice primarily in Wales, but also surrounding areas. The Scots, Irish, and English were migrating to Appalachia well before it was said the practice fizzled out. They wound up in isolated mountainous areas, often without access to certain amenities and services, like doctors or clergy, like priests, to serve any of the Catholic Irish who could perform last rites. People were still dying suddenly, and these communities already had a solution to the problem. Why in the world would sin eating cease? It didn't. From what I can gather from numerous private and personal accounts, sin eating followed basically wherever the early Irish went, so southern Appalachia and the Ozarks. From what I understand, the practice did evolve a little bit. The ritual itself had changes from community to community. The identity of the sin eater was kept secret, going so far as to hide their identity with a cloak and hood when they arrived at a family's home the night prior to burial. The association with evil continued and coalesced into association with magic and witchcraft, and the sin eater did need to be cautious so as not to get caught up in a, like a witch hunt, something stupid like that. And I have heard of another precaution that they might have taken that I haven't read anywhere else online, and I am going to share that with you now. So, I have made a contact recently whose family had early Irish roots in the Ozarks. That is not Appalachia, I know, but still associated, so bear with me. Their family was, and still is, a family of mystics. They know the old world healing ways. They know about curses, hexes, protection spells, working with crossroads and deities. Some of them are gifted with the sight. Others are gifted in other ways. And it has been this way as far back as they can trace. This person's great-great-grandfather was no different. He was involved in his own ways, and he was also a sin eater who was active around the time of the Great Depression, so a few years after Richard Munslow had passed away. However, in their family line, they referred to him as a soul eater. And I will tell you about him as it was told to me. I made some notes, so I will just relay those to you now. Keep in mind, some of these details may be family-centric or like community-centric. So if they don't mesh up, line up with what you already know about sin eaters, if you know about sin eaters, then that may be the reason why. So here we go. At the time, only men could do the work of the soul eater, as it was thought if women did it, they might risk giving birth to the sins, guilt, etc., from one of the souls that they helped. Even at this time, these people were highly stigmatized and associated with darkness and evil things. When their services were required, food, alcohol, or raw lard was placed near the corpse to absorb the sins, the idea being if the sins could be removed from the person, this would negate a potential haunting and ensure the soul could move on. This process was thought more so of as a cleansing ritual, and we can clearly see that concept of transference magic that I introduced in the last episode, the passing of something from one object to another or one body to another. There were different rituals that the soul eater might perform to pull the sin out, different things that they might say. I was told that it depended on the circumstances, but generally the ritual had them eating the food, drinking the drink, saying some words, and then waiting for an indicator that the ritual was complete and had been a success, like a particular flickering of a nearby candle or a reflection of something in a mirror. Now, my contact did not say what it was that they were looking for in the reflection, and this detail in particular is in opposition to a well-known custom in Appalachia of covering all mirrors following a death, so I will try to get clarity on that. Now, following the ritual, they would be paid in goods, services, or favors. And the final detail that was told to me, this ritual, this role of soul or sin eating still exists today. Now, to circle back for a moment to precautions taken, something that this person told me that I haven't seen anywhere else, soul eaters could have help in the form of what she called watchers. These were folks in the community who would keep an eye out on behalf of the soul eater and rush to them with news and updates. They might tell them about a recent death. They might also tell them if there was a brigade of folks unhappy with the dark workings of the soul eater who had found out their identity and were coming their way, you know? So they kept them informed and they kept them up to date on anything of importance taking place. There may be only one watcher. There may be numerous. They could simply be friends of the soul eater. However, many times it was a service that they were fulfilling in order to pay back a favor. A favor like, you know, the soul eater doing their family the solid of removing sins from a departed family member. Is this not the most fascinating thing you have ever heard? My contact's ancestor was a gangster, yo. A gangster. I do apologize for
saying contact and, you know, being all cloak and dagger about their identity. I would love nothing more than to have her on the program to come and talk to us all about this. I have spoken with her regarding an appearance, so we shall see if we can make that materialize in the new year. But until then, I think we can just appreciate the cool information and the understanding that not only did sin eating make its way into the American South, Appalachia or otherwise, but it is perhaps ongoing still. Today, we are talking about the death culture of Appalachia. It's got a lot of features to it, and we've got a lot of information to get through. I remember early on being especially drawn to this concept. It didn't take long to understand that Appalachia has had an incredibly unique relationship with death, unlike any other place that I have come to learn about in the States. Death in early Appalachia was a fairly regular, familiar event. There was more sickness and disease without vaccines, more injuries that couldn't be tended to by doctors, higher maternal and infant mortality rates. It was inevitable, and the folks fatalistic about its existence and practical upon its arrival. It wasn't treated like it is today, you know, sanitized and distant. It was a part of life, but also afterlife. When someone died, the community came together in order to help the family get through it and also ensure their transition to life following the loss. They took care of each other because no one else could. The beliefs and practices observed, some of which are still observed today, came with the immigrants from the old world, like the concept of the sin eater early Scotch-Irish, English, and German settlers brought with them traditional funerary beliefs and rituals. Pockets of these death beliefs and customs formed in isolated mountain communities, staying that way for hundreds of years and preserving the older ways as the world around Appalachia marched forward. Perhaps we can know so much about Appalachian death culture now because it persisted for so long, with some of their far more isolated communities observing these practices and rituals right up to the 1960s, when Big Casket and Big Funeral finally got a hold of them. So we will be exploring numerous features of the death culture in the region for the remainder of the episode that will touch upon the paranormal, the superstitious, and the magical. But before we can get into the omens, the signs, and the entities people believed lurked at the edges, we have to talk about what death actually looked like for them, what it meant to them, what happened to the body, who touched it, who watched over it. Because for mountain families, death wasn't some vague mystery you sent away to be dealt with. Oh, no, no, no. When death came a knockin', you took part in the step-by-step ritual process that followed. Death was personal, intimate, sacred, and meaningful. And the departed stayed right where they belonged until the very last minute, at home. As soon as possible following a confirmed death in the community, if there was an established church in the area, the bell began to toll. A ring rang out for every year of the deceased person's life. This event alone could tip off members in the community as to who it was who had passed, if it had been expected. I can only imagine the searing grief at an unexpected bell that only rings a couple of times. At the bell's toll, you stopped what you were doing and you listened, counting along before then making your way directly to the deceased's family's home. A lot was about to happen, and happen quickly, and you needed to be ready, whatever was asked of you. The entire community showed up. Notice would be posted in local community buildings or available storefronts, and for family members who were out of town, a black-edged letter announcing the news would quickly be sent, with the hope of at the very least letting them know of the passing and at most alerting distant members to catch the next era-appropriate transport back home before the burial. The window of time between death and burial was very short, but people did make it back if they could. It was important to do so. Friends, family, and neighbors would begin to congregate at the family's home, many with food in hand and all of them ready to comfort or support. Clocks were stopped to mark the time of death, and because time no longer existed for the departed. Mirrors were covered. You certainly didn't want the departed's spirit to be confused should they see themselves in a reflective surface. And it was an omen that if the living caught their own reflection, they may be the next to go. One of the first steps was called the laying out, or preparation of the body. Women would take charge in the washing of the body and also the sewing of their burial shroud. In other communities and other times, actual burial clothes might be made from hand for the deceased. If you were not called upon for either of these things, you could clean the home, immediately begin to gather flowers and herbs, which was a very important part of this process, or you could begin to prepare food and drink for everybody. Men would construct or set up what was called a cooling board. This was simply a flat platform on which to place the deceased until their casket was ready, and could be anything from a door, ironing board, table, or old planks fastened together. This would generally be placed in the parlor, covered by a cloth, on which the body was to be situated, tied down so as to keep them from sliding off or sitting up. Measurements were taken and construction on the casket would begin. Arms were crossed over the chest and coins placed over the eyes to keep them from opening. Not only would that be very creepy, but at least one belief held you needed to enter heaven with your eyes closed so you may present yourself humbly to God. All of the previously gathered flowers and herbs were placed near the body so as to mask the smell as decomposition progressed. An old Scottish tradition had the eldest female of the family placing a bowl upon the body and scooping 3 handfuls of salt into it. This was thought to protect the person's spirit from evil entities and negative energies. This had to be done early in the process, as the person's soul was thought to remain in the body for the first 24 hours and would be most vulnerable to those influences during this time. At the beginning of the first night was the next stage in the process, the wake, or sitting up with the dead. Most everyone would leave come nightfall, save for neighbors, close friends, and relatives who would remain close, guarding the corpse and keeping vigil through the night. They would spend the evening telling stories about them and singing hymns together. The following morning, digging of the grave began. It was bad luck to leave an open grave to sit overnight. At home, if possible, a minister would come in to say a prayer over the body. Once this was done, the body would be placed in its coffin, constructed by a local craftsman entirely for free. The coffin could be a very basic construction of planks. However, it wasn't uncommon at times to simply hollow out a large chunk of oak tree, line it with a quilt, and call it good. They were then carried from the home. Many homes were constructed with an additional door that was extra wide, also referred to as the funeral door. You may have also heard it called a death door. As the name implies, this door was for the dead and not used for regular entry. The deceased was to be carried out feet first, as it was thought if they were carried out head first, they might catch someone's eye and take them with them. In the olden days, the person would be buried right on their land. As time progressed, they may have more likely been walked or carted to the church graveyard. Preferably, their grave would sit atop a hill. The purpose worked twofold. Set in a hill meant any rainwater would not pool in the coffin, and two, being buried higher up meant they were closer to heaven. Once they were set, only the closest of friends and family were to fill in that hole. This was an incredibly sacred act and the final interaction to be had with the departed to help send them on their way. Death was not taboo in Appalachia as it is now. It was reality. It was love. It was the last acts that you could do for a person to show your love and respect. I have taken part in part of this process for a family member of mine. I was told we were doing it this way because he had Viking heritage. I still don't know if that is true. I'm not studying Vikings, but I do know it was quite Irish, Scottish, and English, all of which I personally have heritage in, so saith 23andMe. And it was beautiful. It was hard, and it was beautiful. It was weird, but it was beautiful. I don't know what else to say about it, only that I might be able to empathize the littlest of bits with the thoughts and feelings one had as they prepared a deceased loved one. I've had a sense of more closure while retaining my sad emotions with this specific family member. I've been able to retain memories from that day more clearly, while other funeral experiences, they can come back to me a little blurry. And for my spiritually inclined, I have had more contact with this family member on the other side than any other that I have lost, if you are a believer in such things. I don't know if that is normal. I just like to think of it as I established a deeper connection with this family member on that day. I presume Appalachians of old were able to retain deep connections to their past family members as well. Getting off track, redirecting back to the process. Once the person was buried, everyone returned back to the family's home for a final gathering. They would eat, drink, clean up, and put plans in motion as to how best to help the family carry on and survive, especially if the deceased was the father of the family. In those early years, he would have been the main provider of anything outside of the home. So anyone in the community who could stepped in and stepped up, depending on what the family would need help with following their loss. What I have described here for this process was an ideal version with a quick turnaround and no hitches. Sometimes families would wait extra days, especially if they knew distant relatives were trying to get home for the burial. If the death occurred during winter, there was no digging any 6-foot-deep hole in ground frozen solid, so the body would be put somewhere cool, potentially for months, and then the process would resume once the spring thaw came around. I will also note this process may have looked quite differently depending on the area that it took place. Nowadays, a lot of the older traditions directly involved with the death, the preparation, and the burial of a person are no longer widely practiced. Back in the day, it was community. It was family who dug the grave. That is going to be pretty frowned upon by funeral directors and cemetery coordinators of the modern era. You start digging up their graveyard. The funeral home now handles the washing and dressing of the body. Floral arrangements, funeral invites, service announcements. They sell you the coffin. They carry the body to the cemetery. You send the corpse away pretty quickly for embalming rather than keeping them at home. Commercialization of this entire process takes it completely out of your hands and has turned any form or piece of this tradition that may still be practiced anywhere into something like creepy and weird. So those days are long gone, foremost, but there are still glimmers of that original tradition and reverence for the departed. And there are still some folks who quietly coordinate home funerals, preparing the body and such. It is still incredibly important today that Appalachian family members make the effort to get home and to gather. Friends and neighbors still bring food, stay for hours and support and comfort, tell stories about the departed and keep an eye on the family in the aftermath. Reverence for the dead can still be seen when folks pull to the side of the road as a funeral procession rolls by. I think that is so cool. I didn't know people did that until I started getting into this one. People do this out of respect and remembrance. Even if you didn't know the person, you just do it out of reverence. You can see this reverence in Appalachia ongoing still with the care and maintenance of a gravesite that some Appalachian families take upon themselves to do. Actually, so there is this little known but incredibly important tradition called Decoration Day that I learned about in Jake Richards' book, Backwoods Witchcraft, and it is so cool. So this tradition ties in alongside other forms of ancestor worship that is so important to many of the more magically inclined Appalachians. In the spring, a family will come together for a meal before heading out to the cemetery. There, starting with the kids' graves, they will set about to dressing, cleaning, and decorating the graves of their family members. Following the children are the elders, followed by everyone else. Items are left on the graves, including flowers, food, liquor, cigarettes, or toys for the children, things that it was thought or known that that person would enjoy. After family is tended to, they then move on to do the same with any other graves in the cemetery that are especially worn down with indiscernible inscriptions. Their tombstones or plaques are scrubbed, the area picked up, and extra flowers brought along are laid down for them. It's a cool tradition, and I'm so glad to know something like that still takes place. You know, honor your ancestors, honor the dead. 'Tis the Appalachian way. But honoring death did not begin and end with a corpse. When you tend to it, treat it with respect, remember it so deliberately, when you are so intimate and familiar with its presence, when it so frequently visited your community, you may learn to recognize its approach. Appalachians didn't just respond to death, they anticipated it and figured out ways to avoid it, if possible. You see, death rarely arrived without some kind of sign. But luckily for them, they learned to read those signs and realize there were many, many ways to portend its arrival and dodge death's grasp altogether. Let's talk about the omens that death was coming and the superstitions they abided by in order to avoid it. Most of the following info comes from the books Backwoods Witchcraft and Witches, Ghosts, and Signs, and a website called Death Superstitions and Traditions in Appalachia. Most of these were new to me, so let me know if you learned any of these growing up, and if you still abide by any. Appalachians believed death was coming for someone in general if you dreamed about a wedding or birth, a picture falls off the wall on its own, you hear howling dogs at night, a screech owl at dusk, a whippoorwill ever, if you see a falling star, if you bring a shovel or axe into the house, if you hear the walls creak, if you put your shoes on the kitchen table or on top of a bed, if a bird flies through your window, if a bat flies into your house, if a blossomed apple tree falls, death, death, death. Also, never point at a graveyard, especially one with a fresh grave in it. It invites death right in. Death may be coming for someone in particular if a woman cuts out a dress for herself on a Friday and does not finish it before end of day, she is doomed to die before end of year. Someone who eats fruit that grew in a graveyard will also die before the year is up. Quite specifically, eating blackberries on or after September 29th dooms the eater to death before the year is up. If you hear a cock crow at midnight, you will die before dawn. If you watch a black dog walk away from you, you're watching it walk away with your soul and then you'll be dead. Walking behind someone in their footsteps dooms that person to die. Don't do that. Why would you do that to somebody? If a thread knots up on a lady while sewing, she will surely die. If a bride breaks her wedding ring, she has definitely added her husband's name to death's waiting list. A pregnant woman who gazes upon a corpse marks her unborn baby for death. If you shorten a baby's dress, you shorten its life. If a baby looks into a mirror during its first year, they will not live long. If you dream of your teeth falling out, this is a premonition that a close friend or family member is not long for this world. Following a funeral, whichever sex leaves the graveyard first will designate the sex of the next person to be buried there. Finding a gaggle of blackbirds hanging around outside of your home following a funeral meant there was more death to follow. If a picture falls within your home and breaks, the person in the picture will die. If a clock stops without being run down, the hour at which it is frozen marks the hour of your very dear friend's death. A twofer for my blissfully wedded folks. If a pillow falls off the wedding bed, the first to lie their head upon it for slumber will die before their partner. But if you know the following workaround, you might still be safe. Whoever falls asleep first on the wedding night will die first. Someone in your family will perish should four stalks of a lily come up to bloom, should someone cut a new door out in their house where a window previously stood, if you hear three knocks at the door, if a filled grave sinks quickly, if a board warps in the porch, if a peach tree blooms twice in 1 year, and if you hang your hat on a doorknob. You are surely inviting death into your family home.
This isn't just a game. It's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Now for some good old straight Appalachian superstitions involving death. Death always comes in threes. And you know what? I had not been taught this, but what is interesting is this is something I just noticed growing up. Celebrities always die in three, dudes. It's weird. Okay, Michael Jackson, Farrah Fawcett, Ed McMahon, didn't they literally die on the same day, yo? Lauren Bacall, Richard Attenborough, and Robin Williams, my childhood, all in the same month. That was a really hard one. Dude, 2014 period was a hard one. Philip Seymour Hoffman, Joan Rivers, what? Anyway, yes, threes. Appalachians may have been onto something. If a corpse is very cold, your household will not experience another death for the rest of the year. Bees carry the news of death, and you must tell the bees when there is a death in your family. Circle of life and death in the Great Smokies, right there. Hold your breath when you pass a graveyard, or spirits may enter your mouth or nose, and do not speak while in a graveyard or look back as you exit one, or the spirits will follow you home. Also, don't walk on a grave. You risk the grave owner's spirit haunting you, and it's just plain rude. Now, if this should happen, this seems like a good place to insert a neat granny magic method for ridding yourself of said spirit and returning them where they belong. Unfortunately, this won't work for everyone. You do need to actually know the person doing the haunting and have been close enough to them that you have access to some of their things. So here it is. Cut a potato in half, hollow it out, place a small item previously belonging to the spirit in question into the potato, and close up both ends. Bind it together with red yarn and pin it shut with nails for good measure. Take the potato charm back to the cemetery, over to the spirit's grave, and leave it there. This not only brings them back, but it binds them to their grave until they decide to finally cross over. You never know when you'll need something like this, so I sure do hope this helps someone. If you would like to deter death from visiting your home, every person in your household should place their shoes sole side up beneath their beds. Never rock an empty rocking chair, and if someone gets up from one, never let a moving rocking chair stop on its own, or death may come and have a seat. And here is an alternate take on a funeral superstition I mentioned previously. When someone dies, stop all of the clocks in the house in order to prevent yet another death. Hoodoo tells us we should also sweep following a funeral in order to remove death's energy and prevent the spirit from returning. This will also help us break any lingering sorrow over the loss. Sweep the threshold, the doorway, and the path the body was taken out. Don't sweep before the body is removed, as you will shorten your own life, and don't sweep under a sick person's bed, or you will shorten theirs. Jake Richards says in Backwoods Witchcraft that old-timer Appalachians were deeply superstitious about certain things, one of which was death. Very superstitious about it. They were also very superstitious about ghosts, witches, curses, and lightning, and we will cover those in our next episode. Before we move on, since we are on the topic of death, omens, and superstition, I wanted to share something I recently learned. It's a strange connection between Appalachian superstitious beliefs and old world beliefs in some parts of Europe, particularly Eastern Europe and the Balkans. In Appalachian death culture, the following were not unusual beliefs. Don't let a cat jump over a corpse, or it could result in a restless spirit or haint. Carry a corpse from the home feet first so they can't look back and decide to stay or catch someone's eye, causing their death. People who commit suicide, those who practiced dark magic and died, unbaptized children who died, all of these could lead to restless spirits or haints. The same rules existed for a slightly different reason in parts of Eastern Europe. When these rules were broken there, the dead might indeed return, not as restless spirits or haints, but still something unrested and obsessed with messing with the living. That something was the vampire. Not the pop culture version that immediately came to your mind. There were no fangs, no seduction, no immortality, forever young and beautiful, rich as God for some reason. Early vampires were simply dead people who hadn't properly stayed dead. These were revenants. In Europe, if a cat jumped a corpse, that person was at risk of crawling from their grave later to cause death or illness for others. In Appalachia, it was haints who were thought to be able to cause death and illness, and people went to great lengths to prevent or expel them from their homes. In Europe, the body was carried out feet first, so it couldn't find its way back home once they rose from the grave. In Appalachia, the same underlying idea remains. The restless dead were thought to have enough power to take someone with them. There are also a few that I have learned do a complete 180 on their root cause and result, such as babies who are born with a caul or babies born as the seventh son or daughter. Both of these in older Eastern European folklore remain possible indicators of greater risk of becoming a vampire upon death. These same individuals born within the Appalachian belief system are thought to be naturally gifted people and able to help folks with abilities like second sight or healing gifts, you know, stuff like that. So the pattern doesn't necessarily remain consistent across the board, but the fact that they share so many superstitions in the first place is incredibly interesting. That is a side quest for another day. Let's talk about spooky architecture for a moment. Specifically, let's dig deeper into death doors. The tradition of installing and using death, funeral, mourning, casket, or coffin doors began to emerge in New England and Appalachia in the 18th century. This feature was a second front door, usually built for entry and exit on the ground level, leading to the parlor or living room of a home, cut extra wide in order to fit a coffin through. It was considered improper for the dead to be removed through a door the living had used, and also the living to ever use this door reserved solely for the dead. It was also thought improper to try and turn the inhabitant of a coffin all topsy-turvy and sideways in an attempt to cram him out a window or through a regular-sized door, so this was a logical solution. Doorways and their thresholds play an important role in Appalachian superstition, and there are many beliefs revolving around them within the folkloric and magic traditions of the region. Numerous superstitions involve a broom placement by the door or across the threshold to prevent witches or evil from entering. Certain spells and charms are created near, over, or inside the doorway. Doorways were liminal spaces, portals, significant locations for specific spirit and magical works. So someone goes and places a door that is only for the dead, you're going to wind up with some pretty incredible beliefs and superstitions about it. The use of the death door helped to designate a distinct boundary between the worlds of the living and the dead. Another reason for not walking them out of the living's door was due to love and care for the person in their hereafter. You didn't want a chance that the departed might become confused at a threshold meant for the living, otherwise they might decide to linger there or get stuck. Some Appalachian ghost lore falls in line with old European ghost lore that said spirits can return the way that they had gone. So even if you had done everything right, they might still wind up back at the threshold of the death door, though unable to go through it. They would just stand there, knocking, until someone let them back inside. Sometimes you might catch a glimpse of a spirit if you look through an open death door. And you were never to play or dilly-dally near one, as something unseen on the other side may reach through and pull you into their world. So, death in Appalachia had its rules, its traditions, even had its own door. It was a personal, intimate affair. Most anything to do with a particular death revolved primarily around the remaining family members and departed loved ones and took place within their private homes where they could navigate the parts within their control in a situation that was completely out of their control. They took death head on as best they could once it arrived, respectfully, thoroughly. They learned to read the signs prior to its potential arrival and perform the actions necessary to ward it off. But sometimes it couldn't be avoided and had already arrived. There was nothing to be done but wait for it to show its face. Death and misfortune could be preceded by an omen of a different sort, an entity morally ambiguous, laser-focused, and observing from the dark, whose sole purpose lied in announcing the very presence of its master, Death, loyally standing guard at the threshold, awaiting its owner's knock at your door. In the springtime of the late 1800s, a young geology student and budding photographer headed out by horse and wagon to explore, take specimens, and photograph the impressive landscape of Hanging Hills, specifically West Peak, near the city of Meriden, Connecticut. Shortly into his journey, a short-haired black dog, not of exceptional size, emerged from somewhere in the woods to join him, and being a friendly little guy, continued to trot and move along with the student as he moved from one area to the next. Even after the man's descending from the mountain for dinner in the local Southington, upon his return, his canine companion awaited, ready for the next leg of their journey together. By the end of the day, the man had circled back, and at the same spot he had met the little chap took one last look at him before merrily trotting off and disappearing back into the trees. And that was that. 3 years later, the student would return to West Peak accompanied by a friend and fellow geologist who he had encountered the night before, and upon catching up, the student had shared details about his previous visit and his encounter with the friendly dog. His friend smiled, saying he too had met the pup before, twice. And actually, there was this superstitious legend the locals would tell you about this right smart canine, and it went thus. If a man shall meet the black dog once, it shall be for joy, and if twice, it shall be for sorrow, and the third time, he shall die. But again, just a silly local superstition. No one of a scientific and sound mind would pay any heed, except perhaps to get a kick out of such a strange omen of predestiny actually being believed by anyone. That following morning, the men set out, heading for West Peak, burdened by their equipment and an especially cold and snow-heaped path. They would encounter such a barrier to reaching the peak the way they had intended that they decided to change plans and go around to the steeper, windier, but less snow-covered side. The ascent and arrival to the peak was perfection. They did all the work they had intended and began their descent. Partway down, the student's friend suddenly halted, pointing. Atop one of the cliff faces jutting out stood the black dog, watching the two, before turning and bounding away. His friend turned to him, suddenly serious, and whispered something to the effect of, "I didn't believe it before, but I do now. This was three." Before the student could respond, the rock beneath his friend's feet abruptly gave way and he quickly plummeted out of sight. It was his friend's third time and his second. His friend met death while he met sorrow. Now, this tale is a fictitious one, originally published in 1898 in the Connecticut Quarterly, written by William Pynchon. It may have been inspired by prior tales local to Connecticut, but I more so suspect that it was inspired by the living black dog lore itself. The author takes some liberties, but the fact of this particular lore remains. The black dog was seen as an omen of death and misfortune. And this story was told so well and contained elements that these folks were already familiar with that many people actually took it as true at the time of its publishing. In stories of the past, sometimes the black dog is a bit more ghostly, like in the tale of the Black Dog of the Blue Ridge Mountains out of Virginia, or the Ghost Dog of Goshen Hill from South Carolina. Or they can be more physical, like we see in the fiction story I just told, and in more modern accounts of the encounter. Miners sometimes swore they saw large black dogs near the shafts. For them, this was an omen of certain tragedy in the operation, a collapse, an explosion. Coal Country has tons of stories and superstition about the black dog. Harlan County has held for centuries there are black dogs, or as they term it, hellhounds, loping around on the back roads, but in particular on Black Mountain. Those who dared camp out there reported feeling watched, hearing growling, seeing glowing eyes from the dark of the trees. In Pike County, the Kentucky Hellhound prowls around and has been accused of killing locals' cattle. So real a beast it is that there is an old $200 reward for anyone who can bring it in. The offer is still available for the taking to this day. Many long-haul truckers have shared tales of seeing black dogs during their trips. Often, they will appear if the driver is on an especially long one. Maybe been going too hard, maybe starting to nod off. Then, bam, a black dog runs out in the road. The driver jerks awake, swerves to miss him, jackknifes the truck, rolls over, kills others. Beware the black dog. Hypnagogic hallucinations aside, this is actually a great use of black dog lore as a cautionary tale. Don't drive sleepy, guys. Non-hypnagogic hallucinations aside, long-haul truckers have just about the quickest turnaround from omen to result. Another quick turnaround was an Appalachian belief about black dogs in some rural areas that if one suddenly showed up and set up shop right outside a cabin window, someone inside surely wouldn't make it through the night. This creature remains a part of locals' death superstition and high strangeness to this day. I saw an interesting account on Facebook that I will link the full post to so that you can read the woman's actual story, but she talks about her family member having hit a black dog with his vehicle. This was in Kentucky, I believe. When he got out to look, there was no body or indication of anything having happened. He would pass away not too long after the incident. Should this have been taken as an omen? Was it connected to something a bit more? I don't know. It's certainly a strange coincidence, and it fits the narrative. Seeing this story reminded me actually of a story told to me for this show, and you can go listen to the entire thing as well. You should, because it's super creepy. It's included in my summer bonus series on YouTube, and the video is titled Spectral Shorts Number 4. I will tell you the short and sweet of it here, though. So this man and his brother hit a black dog with their car. When they went to look, there was no body. And when they got to their destination and did a closer inspection of their car, there was no evidence of impact or accident or anything. Now, just moments prior to even seeing the dog jump into the road, my storyteller felt compelled to tell his brother, who was driving, no matter what happens next, do not turn. After all was said and done, they both realized that right at the location of this incident, the brother said his impulse was to swerve, and if he had, it would have taken them right into the telephone pole just there on the side of the street, potentially killing them both. But he didn't, because of what my storyteller had said to him. They avoided death by reacting to an omen due to prior information that they shouldn't have had in the face of an event they couldn't have foreseen. How about them apples? Fascinating stuff. You should definitely catch the full story and then go listen to the rest of the show. The following storyteller is comedian Joey Gaynor, who told me a story about the Comedy Store in L.A. that was originally featured on Unsolved Mysteries back in the day. Yeah, the original Unsolved Mysteries. No shade, though, to the current Unsolved Mysteries. I love you guys. Hire me for something, okay? Please? All right. Here is one more Appalachian black dog story. I saved this one for last because it's spooky, it has elements of validity to it, and it incorporates a feature about the black dog that hails from older legends about the creature from early British lore. They may be an omen of death, but they are also a guardian of it. This story occurs over many time periods, and as far as we know, is still ongoing today, taking place just outside of Valle Crucis, North Carolina. Legend in the area has it that townsfolk in the 1860s discovered human remains in the aftermath of what appeared to be an animal attack in the woods nearby St. John's Episcopal Church, just off of Highway 194. At the time, it is said the minister took the opportunity presented to him and weaved a tale of a demonic animal overtaken by Satan who would attack sinners and the unrepentant, encouraging more people to join his congregation for all of the right reasons, you know, just some good old fear-mongering. So, fast forward over a century later. Two fellas who were students at a nearby university were driving at night down Highway 194, just outside of Valle Crucis. As they went to pass the old stone church and its graveyard, a very large black thing quickly moved from the shadows of the tombstones and in front of their car. The driver swerves to miss it, slightly clipping the animal, and pulls off to the side of the road. They look behind them to see what it was. A bear? A deer, maybe? Nope. In the middle of the dark road were two glowing, menacing red eyes. Now, I am sure the men didn't know of any animal that could do that with their eyes, but whatever this thing was, it was humongous and angry and now growling a guttural, loud, steady growl. The thing stepped toward them into the light of the moon, and now the men stared in horror at what they saw. It seemed to be a black dog, but it was as big as a deer. Its red eyes burned bright, its teeth gleamed as it snarled, and then it lunged at them. Terrified, the men gunned it. Dangerously, they made their way down the mountain highway at 50 miles an hour, squealing around hairpin turns, and when it felt like they had put a little bit of distance between themselves and this monster dog, the driver glanced toward his mirror. To his horror, he could still see the dog because it was right on their tail. Panicking, the driver pushed it faster. The thing kept up. He pushed it faster. The thing gained on them. He pushed it faster as they flew over a bridge that ran over where multiple rivers converge, forming the shape of a cross, hence the name of the town, Valle Crucis, Valley of the Cross. Glancing at the mirrors, they watched as the dog simply vanished. Completely traumatized, they sped away to safety. This encounter allegedly took place in the 1980s. Well, these guys would not be the last to encounter something like this in the area. About 7 years ago, a person posted in the Backwoods Creepy subreddit detailing two experiences they had had in the area. And if you listen to the podcast Spooked, you have heard about this. When this person was a young kid, he was on vacation at a nearby home with his family. He would end up going on a last-minute store run with his uncle because they were expecting to get a lot of snow that night. They had to take 194 into town, and says upon passing St. John's, he noticed a change in his ordinarily jovial, fun-loving uncle. He noticed him tensing up, continuing to check the rear view as their speed steadily increased. This was a twisty, mountainous road, and the poster says that they must have been doing like around 60 around these turns. He finally went to look behind them and says he saw two burgundy-colored eyes right behind the truck. He said they smoldered like embers. He also says seeing this did something to time, like his perception of time. Suddenly came to because there was a knocking on the rear window of the cab, and the poster says he knew that what he had just seen, the thing with the eyes, was now in the bed of the truck. His uncle gunned it forward, and then he heard tapping on his passenger side window. His uncle looked before he did and told him that no matter what, do not look. And he doesn't. Side note, North Carolina, what's going on? What's happening over there with your creatures getting into people's moving trucks? This isn't the same area as the That's Not Human 911 call, but still, y'all, you got some quick critters over yonder. That's, are you guys okay? Are you doing okay? All right, back to it. So at this point in the guy's story, he hasn't seen what this thing is, right? Just the red eyes. So a couple of years pass. He says he and his family were back out there for another vacation, and this time he had brought a buddy along with him. On one of the days, the whole family piles into a van and they head to a local town in the area for dinner. Everyone is in seats except for he and his friend, who are in the very back in the cargo area of the van. They get to dinner, they eat dinner, and then they head back. It is now nighttime. Back on 194, they had just passed the church when suddenly the van stalls. Ooh. While the family is sitting there trying to figure out what to do, he notices his friend just staring out the back window at something, just transfixed. He looks and sees what it is. Only a few feet away was something that looked like a big black wolf with ember-like yellow eyes standing on two legs and staring at him. At some point, one of the poster's family members had to have seen it because they suddenly start screaming, "Get the van started! Go, go, go now!" Right? Along those lines. I don't know what they said. The van does start. They begin to move, and the storyteller and his friend are just watching out the back window as this thing drops to all fours and begins to chase them. He said they got up to like 60, and this creature stayed right on them. And then this is basically where the story ends. Someone asked him in the comments what happened after this, you know, or like how far did it chase them? And he said he couldn't remember anything but waking up back at the house. So we get a little sense of that time slippage that he'd experienced the first time, right? Pretty neat story, yeah? I want to recognize that this story rides a line between what we might think of as black dog lore and, say, dogman lore. And we might end up bringing this case back up when we do look at dogman accounts. But I wanted to include it here, because it still fits so much of the black dog narrative. Accounts of the black dog often, not always, but often include how large it is, just bigger than anything, how black it is, how its eyes shine or glow unnaturally. Some traditional black dog lore does include the ability to stand on its hind legs, and other abilities, supernatural abilities. But an interesting indicator that this is a black dog story is the area, always right outside this church. A very long time ago, when a new church was built, sometimes people would bury a black dog alive on the church grounds so that its spirit would patrol and guard the cemetery, which is absolutely awful. But it helped feed into the propagation of black dog lore and perpetuate this entity's position as a companion to death. That was a lot today. Thank you for hanging in there with me if you have made it this far. Appalachian death culture is a Venn diagram of sorts, isn't it? So many features to explore, all unique in some way to Appalachia. For time's sake, we are leaving out another entity and precursor to death that I had intended to talk about, the Banshee. We will find a good home for her somewhere else in the season, though. Next time, we'll be taking our last look into this magical corner of Appalachia. We are diving deep into superstition, talking a little bit about hexes, curses, and protecting oneself from them. And then we will be exploring these don'ts and no-you-didn'ts I've been hearing so much about. This will be an exciting turning point in the show because in the new year, we launch the next leg of the journey. Creatures, cryptids, shapeshifters, monsters. If it's the very reason we do not look in the trees, we are talking about it. Ugh, so exciting, dudes. Before I sign off, I want to thank my newest patron for becoming part of the PGP community and helping support the show. Tara Lathan joined my baby ghost tier. Just a massive, major shout out goes to you. This really is a labor of love, and I appreciate you becoming an integral part of this journey. I hope you enjoy the extras and the earlies, my dear. And Tara, I'll be seeing you in the PGP backrooms, all right? Anyone can easily support the show by becoming a patron if you simply like what I'm doing and wish to support that, or you want to see more and get early access to regular episodes, pull on up to patreon.com/paranormgirlpod. Other ways to easily support include following on social at paranormgirlpod, leaving a cool review and rating, and by sharing the show with people you think would love giving it a listen. Any thoughts, questions, or personal spooky experiences that you would like to hear featured on the program can be sent to paranormgirlpod@gmail.com. One final brief announcement is for my homies in the paranormal investigation field. On Friday, February 13th, there will be an investigation taking place at the Dr. Martin Walton House in Springfield, Tennessee. Gear, food, and access to this historic destination will be provided for a one-night private investigation, and you and seven of your friends have the opportunity to be there to investigate alongside Tennessee's own RKB Paranormal. RKB is currently conducting a raffle for the spot. You can get one ticket for $10, three for $25, or five for $40. You know how expensive getting into an awesome haunted location can be. Imagine paying just 10 buckaroos and being the lucky winner. And even if you are not, you can still feel good about trying because 100% of the proceeds will go to benefit the Dr. Martin Walton House Museum. It is always a win to see local history curated and preserved, but I do hope you win the investigation as well, though. To enter and snag your tickets, send a direct message to Damien at RKB Paranormal on Facebook or Instagram. You have until January 31st, 2026 to enter. The winner will be drawn live at 7 p.m. Central, February 1st. You must be 18 years or older to enter. May the odds be ever in your favor. That is a wrap. Thank you so much for catching this one. I will not be back with the next until after Christmas, so may you all have a happy, safe, and warm one. Until next time, stay safe, keep the nightlight on, and sleep with one eye open.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.